Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to take that complex stack of sources, all those articles and specialized research you're looking at, and really break them down to give you the essential knowledge you need to be informed and fast. Today, we're diving deep into the skies, or maybe more accurately, into the hangars right beneath them. We're going to explore a really crucial and honestly often misunderstood area of aviation: maintenance compliance. The topic today really centers on the reality of the modern aviation technician. These are people with incredibly valuable skills, valuable certifications, who are increasingly taking on side work. We're calling it maintenance moonlighting. And yeah, we're pulling that term directly from the classic 80s TV show Moonlighting.
Right, Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
Exactly. Just like they were always on the hunt for the next PI gig, today's certificated aviation mechanics are, you know, leveraging their expertise to work for multiple employers. And in doing so, they're solving some serious personnel gaps across the entire industry. Now, this flexibility is, of course, fantastic for the technician's bank account, and it's absolutely critical for the industry's efficiency. But when you introduce a highly regulated environment like air travel, maximizing your personal value inevitably introduces some complex and, frankly, what our source material calls sexy regulatory compliance issues.
That phrase really captures the whole situation perfectly, doesn't it? The mission for this deep dive is to unpack those exact compliance demands, specifically the requirements around federal drug and alcohol testing. This is the stuff that can transform a really profitable side gig into a potential regulatory trap under 14 CFR Part 120. And for the individual, this isn't just about some administrative oversight. It's a career-defining risk.
And we are relying on a truly expert foundation today. The analysis we're doing is built on an article that synthesizes all these complex legal, policy, and operational requirements that govern aviation maintenance. We're fortunate that the source material draws so heavily on the experience of some of the most specialized professionals in international aviation safety law.
Yeah, the depth of knowledge you need to navigate these regulations is just... it's profound, because they intersect with policy, with law, and with operational logistics. The insights we're discussing today come from leaders in this field, particularly Sarah McLeod. She's a managing member of Obadal Filler McLeod & Klein PLC, and she's also a founder and the executive director of the Aeronautical Repair Station Association, or IRSA. I mean, she has been advocating and consulting on these precise matters: international aviation safety law, policy compliance, since the 1980s. That's an entire career dedicated to defining the boundaries of safety on a global scale.
And that long view is absolutely essential, right? Because these regulations, they don't just exist in a vacuum. They evolve over decades of industry practice and political advocacy. The sources also mentioned Brett Levanto. He's the vice president of operations at the same firm, Obadal Filler McLeod & Klein. He manages the firm and client communications related to all these intricate regulatory and legislative policy initiatives, while also providing that critical strategic support for ARS.
So we're really getting the view from the ground floor here.
We are. We're understanding not just the letter of the law, but how it's being implemented and, you know, communicated in the real world of aviation operations.
It's that combination, isn't it? The long-term legal advocacy and the immediate operational communication. Mm-hmm. That's what makes this source material so valuable for you, the learner.
Exactly. We're moving beyond just the basic compliance checklist. We're focusing on the nuances that trip up even highly competent organizations. So let's jump into the material and start with the core value proposition of this moonlighting technician. Okay, let's unpack this high demand scenario. Why is maintenance moonlighting such a, well, a pervasive trend in aviation right now? I mean, it really boils down to the fact that a certificated AMP mechanic is a genuinely rare and critical asset. Isn't that it?
They're irreplaceable. The FAA airframe and power plant certificate, the AMP, it's the industry's hallmark of technical competence. It signifies not only skills, but regulatory authority.
The legal ability to sign off.
The legal ability to sign off on work that ensures an aircraft is safe for flight. The demand for these individuals is just intense because the industry is facing these systemic personnel gaps. It's driven by retirements, the shift towards highly complex composite materials that require specialized training, and, you know, just overall global fleet expansion.
So when we talk about a major scheduled air carrier, a Part 121 operation, and they suddenly need several specialized technicians for, say, an unexpected maintenance action on a turbine engine component,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a heavy check over a holiday weekend, Their internal workforce might just be saturated, so they turn to these external, flexible, certificated individuals to fill that immediate capacity need.
Absolutely. And the technician benefits by earning a premium for their flexibility, often at peak hourly rates.
Yeah.
And the industry, well, it maintains its operational rhythm and its schedule integrity.
Yeah.
It's a very efficient market response to a persistent labor shortage.
But that immediate benefit is what often distracts both the organization and the individual from the regulatory complexity that's lurking underneath.
That's the trap.
And this brings us to that really powerful, almost poetic observation that was highlighted in the article. Aviation maintenance requires guts and brains without any glory. I just find that phrasing so compelling. It really establishes the high-stakes environment.
It's the perfect setup for this entire compliance discussion. You need guts because you're working on these massive machines, often under tight deadlines in challenging environments, knowing that a single oversight could be catastrophic.
Yep.
You need brains because the technical manuals, the troubleshooting, the systems knowledge, it's encyclopedic.
Mm.
But there is little glory. The mechanic's work is totally invisible to the flying public. It's detailed, it's meticulous, and it's done under constant regulatory scrutiny.
And that invisibility means the administrative compliance burden, the documentation, the tracking, the DNA program management. It's often seen as secondary, or in the case of the Moonlighter, it's just completely misplaced.
Or overlooked entirely.
Which sets the stage perfectly for the hidden risk. Our source material points out two primary areas of compliance awareness that the moonlighting technician has to master. And these are completely separate from their technical ability to fix the aircraft. So what are those crucial areas of knowledge?
Okay, so the first area is inherent to the certificate holder themselves.
Yeah.
They must be acutely aware of the specific certificate under which they're performing the work and, more importantly, under which they are granting that approval for return to service.
So are they signing off under their personal A&P certificate or as a representative of a, say, a Part 145 repair station?
Exactly. That distinction is the difference between personal liability and organizational liability. And it dictates the entire paper trail they have to generate.
Okay, so that's the authority structure.
Mm-hmm.
But the second area, as you alluded to, involves the business structure, which is far more slippery for the freelancer.
It is the most complex point. The second area is fully understanding the business contracts and subcontracts involved. They have to do this to ensure they have proper coverage by the FAA-mandated drug and alcohol testing programs under Part 120. See, when a technician is a traditional W-2 employee, the employer handles all that compliance. But when that same technician becomes an independent contractor, a moonlighter, they become just one node in a potentially complex contractual chain. And the responsibility, it shifts entirely.
So the burden is placed squarely on the individual moonlighter to perform serious, what the article calls detective work, before they even pick up a tool.
That's it.
They can't just assume the Part 121 carrier they're working for has included them in their program, even if the work is being done right next to the carrier's full-time employees.
Correct. The FAA mandates that the entity responsible for the function ensures the coverage. So if the moonlighter is contracting as an individual entity, they carry the burden of ensuring their entity is Part 120 compliant. This investigative requirement, it isn't just about reading the fine print. It's about asking critical questions. Who is my direct employer? Is that entity required to have a Part 120 program? And most importantly, am I currently enrolled and active in a compliant testing pool for this specific job?
Ignoring that due diligence is how that lucrative side job instantly becomes a regulatory landmine.
That's the perfect term for it.
This sounds less like mechanics work and more like corporate contract law research. It fundamentally changes the skill set required to operate successfully in this modern, flexible aviation workforce. You need technical mastery plus regulatory mastery.
Well, the regulation is unforgiving because the function is safety critical. Part 120 is designed to be comprehensive and pervasive, which means it's meant to ensnare any individual performing safety-sensitive functions for regulated entities. If you are touching a certificated aircraft in a way that affects airworthiness, the net applies, whether you're a CEO or a weekend contractor.
Okay, let's pull that regulatory net apart now. Let's focus specifically on 14 CFR Part 120, which is really the cornerstone of the FAA's drug and alcohol testing regime. So what exactly triggers the applicability of Part 120 for an aviation technician?
Part 120 is triggered based on three key conditions, as defined by the FAA and, you know, synthesized in our source material. First, it applies whenever a safety-sensitive function is performed. That's the core activity trigger, which we'll get into in more detail later. Okay. Second, traditionally, this function had to be performed in the United States. And third, the function has to be performed for specific types of federally regulated operators. So a Part 121 scheduled air carrier, a Part 135 commuter or on-demand operation, or a Section 91.147 sightseeing operator.
So those are the regulated clients. If the client is just a private owner flying under Part 91 and they don't operate sightseeing flights, the regulatory burden under Part 120 generally doesn't apply. Even if the work is identical to Part 121 maintenance, it's all about the client.
It's exactly right. The rule is client specific. Now, the mandate itself, which is laid out in Section 220.105 and 120.215, is extremely broad in terms of who must be covered. It requires coverage for any individual performing, ready to perform, or immediately available to perform maintenance or preventive maintenance on an aircraft or component that's subject to Part 120.
That expansion, ready to perform or immediately available, that's where the administrative burden really starts to ramp up. It means employers can't wait until a technician is called up for a specific task. If they're in the pool of personnel that might be deployed, they have to be covered from the moment they report for duty.
Absolutely. I mean, think about the implications for shift scheduling or rotational crews. If a mechanic is standing by at a Part 121 facility, maybe waiting for a maintenance release or a necessary part, they are considered immediately available. If they were subject to a random test during that time and failed, the violation holds up.
Wow.
This requirement is designed to ensure there are absolutely no gaps in coverage during a mechanic's entire working period for one of these regulated entities.
And crucially, the Moonlighter has to understand this applies for each employer they work for. It's not a single portable DNA status. It's tied to the entity that's requiring the work.
That is the most common mistake made by freelance AMPs. They assume because they're in the testing pool at their main job, they're fine everywhere else. The FAA requires the compliance program to be tied to the entity that is contracting the work, period.
So let's get into the actual mechanics of these DNA programs, because this is what the technician is really signing up for. Part 120 doesn't just mean a single drug test. What are all the required types of testing that make this compliance so onerous?
Well, Part 120 mandates five main types of testing, plus follow-up procedures. And all of them have to adhere to these strict federal protocols, you know, chain of custody, confirmation testing. First, there's pre-employment testing. If a moonlighter is contracted as an employee or even as an individual contractor, they have to pass a test before they can perform any safety-sensitive work.
Okay, that's the entry gate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Second, and this is most relevant to the ongoing risk, is random testing. The FAA requires regulated entities to maintain a specific random testing rate. That means a certain percentage of the workforce has to be selected and tested throughout the year with absolutely no advanced warning.
And then there's post-accident, right?
Third is post-accident testing.
Mm.
If an accident occurs that meets specific criteria like loss of life, serious injury, major damage, all safety-sensitive personnel involved are tested immediately.
Makes sense.
Fourth is reasonable suspicion testing. If a supervisor is trained and they suspect an employee is under the influence, they can mandate a test right then and there. And fifth, return to duty and follow-up testing. If an individual tests positive or refuses a test, they cannot return to a safety-sensitive function until they pass a return to duty test and complete a prescribed regimen of unannounced follow-up tests over a set period.
So the Moonlighter isn't just subject to a random test. They have to be enrolled in a program that's large enough and rigorous enough to meet the FAA's annual random rate requirements.
Yeah.
And that random notification can come at any time, which just adds a whole layer of operational complexity when you're bouncing between jobs.
Exactly right. If the Moonlighter gets the call that they've been randomly selected, they have to cease safety-sensitive duties immediately and proceed directly to a collection site. If they delay, it can be considered a refusal, which is treated the same as a positive test. The clock is absolutely unforgiving.
Wow. Now let's talk about that major future development you mentioned, the global expansion. You said that Part 120 traditionally applied only when work was performed in the United States, but a 2024 rulemaking changed this.
It's perhaps the most significant recent development in maintenance compliance. The 2024 rulemaking expanded the applicability of Part 120 to apply worldwide for all FAA-certificated repair stations. That's Part 145. This means essentially globalizing the drug and alcohol compliance requirement.
That is a huge shift. So if an FAA certificated repair station is operating in, I don't know, Singapore or Brazil or the Netherlands, the safety sensitive personnel there, even local hires who aren't US citizens, they now have to comply with the same rigorous USDNA testing mandates.
That is precisely correct. The FAA views the Part 145 certificate as guaranteeing a standard of safety globally, and DNA testing is an integral part of that standard. Now, the source highlights that while this rulemaking is already in effect, the implementation date, the deadline for all global Part 145 facilities to be fully compliant, is December 2027.
December 2027. That sounds like a comfortable lead time, but when you consider the jurisdictional issues, I suspect that time is flying. What are the complex jurisdictional issues that make this global planning so challenging?
Well, the complexity arises because U.S. federal requirements often collide head-on with foreign national laws governing labor, employment, and personal privacy.
Like GDPR in Europe.
Exactly like GDPR. The General Data Protection Regulation imposes very strict rules on collecting, processing, and storing personal health information, which includes drug test results. The FAA requires specific reporting and data retention, which may directly contradict GDPR's rules on data minimization or transfer.
So an FAA-mandated random test result has to be reported to the FAA in the U.S., but that reporting process might actually violate the employee's rights in Germany or France, where mandatory random drug testing can be seen as a violation of bodily integrity or privacy rights under their local labor law.
That's the conflict. Furthermore, many countries have specific labor protections that restrict when an employer can even mandate testing. They often require for cause or reasonable suspicion rather than blanket random testing. So organizations operating globally have to navigate this friction point, comply with the FAA to keep their certificate, while simultaneously complying with local labor courts to avoid massive employment lawsuits. It requires highly specialized international safety law expertise, which is the exact domain of professionals like Sarah McLeod and the guidance provided by RLSA. It's not an HR problem. It's a high-level legal and policy problem.
So that 2027 deadline isn't about setting up a few contracts. It's about potentially restructuring international labor practices to align two distinct legal philosophies: the U.S. approach of pervasive, standardized safety enforcement, and foreign national approaches to individual privacy and labor protection. This really underscores just how foundational Part 120 is to the FAA's whole definition of safety.
It's fundamental.
Okay, let's pivot back to the domestic moonlighter, because this global complexity is mirrored by a contractual complexity right here at home. This is where the intricacies of the FAA's definition of employer in Section 120.7 create the central dilemma for the independent A&P mechanic. So how does the FAA allow regulated entities to use contractors without putting them under the entity's own testing program?
This is the crucial exception. Let's use an analogy. Carrier A, a Part 121 operator, needs heavy maintenance. They contract this work out to Contractor B, who could be a repair station or an individual A&P. Carrier A is not required to include Contractor B's employees or subcontractors in Carrier A's own DNA program. This provides a lot of flexibility.
So Carrier A basically outsources the liability, but they don't outsource the compliance requirement entirely. What are the two non-negotiable conditions for that exception to apply?
The conditions are absolute. The exception is only valid if, one, the contract employee is included under the contractor's FAA-mandated drug and alcohol testing program. The coverage has to exist. It's just under the contractor's organizational structure.
Okay. And number two.
Second, the work must be performed on behalf of the contractor, meaning the work must be performed within the scope of employment of that contractor.
Which means the air carrier, Carrier A, has discharged its duty only by making sure that the contracting entity, Contractor B, presents a verifiable, compliant Part 120 program. It's like a chain of custody for compliance.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And this leads to the massive realization for the moonlighter. If you are an individual A&P mechanic operating as a sole proprietorship, you are Contractor B in this scenario. The source material really emphasizes this point. Any contractor, even an individual certificate holder contracted to perform covered work, must participate in an FAA-mandated testing program.
This is the administrative burden that I think so many technicians just don't calculate into their rates. A freelance A&P operating independently is forced by regulation to set up or at least enroll in what is effectively a fully compliant HR and DNA structure just for themselves.
It is a non-trivial, non-negotiable cost of doing business. The FAA treats the individual A&P who signs a maintenance contract as an employer for regulatory purposes, because they are performing a safety-sensitive function under their own authority. They are legally liable for the function, and thus they are legally required to manage the compliance associated with that liability.
So, okay, if I'm an independent mechanic, I can't set up my own random testing pool. I mean, it has to be statistically significant. I can't just randomly select myself and meet the FAA's standards for unannounced selection. How does a single technician actually achieve this legal compliance?
This is where the industry relies almost entirely on what are called consortia and third-party administrators, or TPAs. The individual technician has to contract with a TPA or join a consortium. A consortium is, well, it's essentially a pool of small employers, including self-employed individuals, all aggregated together to meet the statistical randomness requirements mandated by the FAA.
Can you explain the mechanics of a TPA briefly? Like, how do they function for the Moonlighter? What does that actually look like for the mechanic? Do they just sign up on a website?
It's pretty close to that, but with a lot of paperwork. The TPA manages the entire DNA program. They enroll the individual Moonlighter into their consortium pool. The TPA is then responsible for a few key things. One, maintaining the pool size. They have to make sure the pool is large enough to satisfy the FAA's required random selection rates, which are typically high percentages for both drug and alcohol testing annually. Two, the selection process. They conduct the mathematically random unannounced draws, and they notify the technician if they've been selected. And three, record keeping. They manage all the testing records, the chain of custody forms, and the compliance reporting to the FAA.
And what does this cost the individual technician? I mean, this can't be free.
It is definitely not free, and it drastically affects the economics of moonlighting. A technician has to budget for several costs. First, the annual consortium membership fee, which can range pretty widely, but it ensures they have a valid testing pool structure. Second, the mandatory pre-employment test fee, which is required before they can start working for a new client entity.
Okay.
Third, the cost of any random tests they're selected for. While large carriers might absorb these costs for their own employees, the Moonlighter might have to pay up front, depending on their TPA agreement. And fourth, the cost of their time. If they're randomly selected, they have to take time away from billable work, often with little notice, to complete the collection process within the required time window.
That dramatically challenges the profitability of, say, a one-weekend contract.
Mm-hmm.
If they fail to join a compliant consortium, they might earn $2,000 for the weekend, but they're exposing themselves to 5- or 6-figure fines and certificate suspension if they get audited.
That's the risk-reward calculation they have to make.
This is why the firm's focus on policy communications, managed by individuals like Brett Levanto, is so critical. They help translate this massive legal burden into actionable, understandable requirements for the organizations that employ these contractors.
The consequences of ignoring this are huge, and the burden is intentionally placed on the performing entity. The air carrier, or the large MRO, is protected, provided they verify the contractor's status. But the freelance mechanic, thinking they're just trading services for cash, finds they've inadvertently taken on the regulatory liability of a small corporation.
We've used this term safety-sensitive function repeatedly, but we need to put a fine point on it, because that is the regulatory tripwire. If a technician is moonlighting, they need to know precisely which activities trigger Part 120 compliance and which ones don't. So let's clarify what the FAA considers maintenance or safety sensitive.
The FAA's definition is, as you can probably guess, deliberately broad. It stems from a philosophy that if the work can remotely affect airworthiness, it must be covered. The functions subject to Part 120 include all the core activities that maintain aircraft integrity, inspection, overhaul, repair, preservation, and the replacement of parts.
That list seems comprehensive, but let's go a bit deeper. Does maintenance include only the final assembly, or does it cover preparatory or intermediate work that might seem minor?
The FAA's interpretation leaves absolutely no room for gray area. The source stresses that maintenance includes any step or series of steps in the entire process. Disassembly, cleaning, inspection, repair, replacement of parts, reassembly, and testing. It captures the entire life cycle of the repair or maintenance action.
Any step.
Yeah.
So the mechanic who is just meticulously cleaning a gearbox component in the shop before it gets inspected.
Yeah.
Or the technician running a non-destructive testing, an NDT procedure, on a structural element. Both of those are performing safety-sensitive functions under Part 120.
Absolutely. Those are critical steps that determine the component's fitness for flight. The FAA provides clarity by linking the definition to the procedural documentation. If the step is included in a component maintenance manual, a CMM, or a traveler, a router, a task card, it is part of the maintenance process designed to ensure airworthiness.
And if that process requires a human action,
that action is safety sensitive. even specialized work like welding or sheet metal, when it's performed for a repair and documented under acceptable practices in Section 43.13A, falls under this definition.
Okay, that makes the scope incredibly wide. But we did mention there are contrast activities. What commonly occurs within a repair station environment that is definitively not subject to the DNA requirements?
Yeah, there are clear carve-outs, primarily for tasks that are administrative, logistical, or preparatory, but don't directly influence the final airworthiness determination.
Like what?
Okay, first, receiving inspections. This typically means reviewing shipping documents, counting parts, checking for external damage. It's logistical, not technical maintenance. Second, tool and equipment restoration. Repairing the torque wrench or the hydraulic rig, while obviously necessary for the facility, is not maintenance on the aircraft component itself.
Right.
Third, calibration. Although crucial for accuracy, the calibration lab is typically handling instruments, not the aircraft or its parts. Fourth, engineering functions. So design reviews, stress analysis, or writing maintenance instructions are professional functions, but they aren't the physical, hands-on maintenance defined in Part 120.
And what was the fifth?
And fifth, fabrication for maintenance, specifically when it's allowed by Section 21.9A6. So minor parts made in-house for repair.
The distinction then it really seems to be whether the activity is documented as part of the official safety record for the aircraft.
That is the ultimate definitive compliance indicator. And this is the key piece of tactical knowledge the Moonlighter has to internalize. The source revealed the litmus test that FAA inspectors use during an audit. When in doubt about DNA coverage, the question is the activity required to be documented on a Section 43.9 or 43.11 record?
Let's break down that Part 43 documentation rule for a moment. Part 43 governs maintenance records. Section 43.9 requires the person performing the maintenance to detail the work done, the date, and sign the entry. And Section 43.10 is the formal maintenance release, stating the item is returned to service and is airworthy.
Precisely. The FAA relies on this mandatory paperwork trail. If your name and your certificate number appear on a 43.9 entry detailing the replacement of a hydraulic line on a Part 121 jet, you've just created verifiable, incontrovertible evidence that you performed a safety-sensitive function at that time.
And that evidence is the smoking gun for the compliance auditors. The source material had that really memorable line about FAA inspectors reviewing these records.
It did. They said the documentation makes the individual's performance of the task obvious to an FAA inspector when reviewing maintenance or inspection releases, like shooting fish in a barrel.
Wow.
It means the inspector doesn't have to catch the technician in the act. They just need to pull the logbook, see the name, and then verify that that name appears in a compliant active DNA testing pool for that specific time frame and that specific client.
So if the technician was moonlighting, signed the 43.9, and was not covered by a Part 120 program because they mistakenly thought their main employer's program covered them, or they just hadn't joined a consortium, that maintenance entry is proof of a regulatory violation that is impossible to deny. It closes the compliance loop perfectly for the FAA.
It creates a nearly inescapable trap for the individual who fails to perform their own regulatory detective work. The FAA has structured the system so that the very documentation required to ensure safety is simultaneously the audit tool used to ensure regulatory compliance.
We've established that the definition of performing maintenance is incredibly broad. It's encompassing not just the work itself, but being ready and immediately available. Now, this flexibility allows maintenance providers to structure their workforce efficiently, using contractors, managing shifts, having standby personnel. But it imposes a nonstop, high-level demand for compliance attention.
The key realization here is that compliance cannot be reactive. It absolutely must be proactive and integrated into the planning process from the very beginning. If a maintenance provider is leveraging the flexibility of the Part 120 rules to hire moonlighters, they have to ensure their compliance controls are even tighter than if they were using permanent W-2 staff.
So where must this administrative responsibility be focused? It sounds like it's a three-way requirement spanning HR, contracting, and the technician themselves.
That's right. The administrative planning has to be robust in three specific areas. First, operational planning must include the explicit expectation that an individual will be called upon to perform. If you sign a contract for a technician to be on standby for a week, their DNA coverage has to be active for that entire week, regardless of whether they turn a single wrench. The potential for performance is what triggers the rule.
Not the actual performance, the potential.
Correct. Second, this expectation and the required regulatory compliance must be absolutely clear to human resources and contracting personnel. HR staff at the air carrier, or MRO, need to understand that the term contractor does not mean compliance exempt. The contract itself must contain language mandating that the individual or contracting entity has a currently active FAA-mandated Part 120 program in place. Failing to check that box during onboarding is an instant liability.
Okay, and the third piece?
Third, and most importantly for our audience, the compliance must be explicitly stipulated by any individual accepting safety-sensitive work. The Moonlighter has to treat joining a compliant consortium or TPA as a non-negotiable business expense. It's equivalent to buying liability insurance. They have to be prepared to provide documentation of their active D&A coverage to any client that hires them for Part 121, Part 135, or Part 145 work.
So if the technician doesn't ask the right questions about the client's operation, or they don't have their own D&A program ready to go, they are not only putting their client at risk, but they are personally exposed to the sharpest teeth of the FAA.
Exactly. And this is why the role of specialized counsel, like the work done by Obadal, Filler, McLeod, and Klein, is so vital. They navigate the nuance of who is responsible at which stage of the contract. When you overlay the existing complexities with that 2027 global expansion, where jurisdictional compliance is extremely difficult, the need for meticulous legal planning only escalates.
Let's talk about those consequences in detail. The source material warns that failure to comply with Part 120 is more painful than the cancellation of a television show. What does that mean in real terms for the individual certificate holder?
The penalties are severe. They're designed to deter non-compliance, absolutely. For the individual technician, a proven failure to be covered by a D&A program while performing a safety-sensitive function can result in a few things. First, civil penalties, fines. The FAA can issue massive civil fines. While these often target the employer, the carrier, or the repair station, an individual certificate holder can also face substantial personal financial penalties. We're talking potentially tens of thousands of dollars per violation, depending on the scope and duration of the noncompliance.
Wow. But the fines are probably not even the worst part.
Not at all. The second and perhaps most painful consequence is certificate suspension or revocation. The FAA can initiate Part 821 enforcement proceedings to suspend or permanently revoke the individual's A&P certificate.
Which means their career is over.
It is over. Losing that certificate is losing their entire career. Since the certificate grants the legal authority to perform the work, its suspension turns that highly valuable, highly demanded technician into an instantly unemployable person in the aviation sector.
And what about criminal liability? Is that on the table?
It is. Third, criminal liability. In cases of severe negligence, willful noncompliance, or if the lack of D&A coverage is linked to a major safety incident, criminal charges can follow. Though, to be fair, those are rarer and reserved for the most extreme cases.
It is crystal clear that the financial benefit of moonlighting is just instantly dwarfed by the administrative and legal risk if that regulatory diligence is missing. The value of the skilled technician is completely conditional upon their compliance status.
That's the ultimate conclusion. The skill and knowledge required for maintenance are immense, but the legal framework requires an equal commitment to administrative compliance. The FAA views Part 120 as a fundamental safety pillar, and they enforce it without mercy.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner, now that we've taken this deep dive into the regulatory weeds of maintenance moonlighting? Well, the primary takeaway is that the extreme value of a certificated aviation technician comes tethered to an equally extreme regulatory burden, especially when working independently.
The central lesson is clarity and contract structure. The technician who moonlights cannot, absolutely cannot, rely on assumptions. They have to operate as a mini business and accept the full administrative burden. Compliance hinges entirely on verifying that the entity performing the safety-sensitive function, which could be the individual freelancer, has a currently compliant Part 120 D&A program, most often through a consortium or a TPA.
And the most vital piece of knowledge you can carry away today is the FAA's definitive documentation litmus test. Always remember, if the work you perform is required to be logged on a Section 43.9 or 43.11 maintenance record, you are performing a safety-sensitive function. That documentation is the audit trail, and if you sign it, you must be in a compliant drug and alcohol testing program for that job, without exception.
And, you know, given the intense complexity of this regulatory environment, particularly with the 2027 global expansion of Part 120, we're seeing a clear trend toward the FAA demanding universal safety standards. This raises a really fascinating and, I think, necessary policy question for the future of aviation law.
And what provocative thought should our listener be mulling over as they reflect on this compliance landscape?
The question is this. If the maintenance industry is rapidly moving toward a flexible freelance workforce, and the current system forces the individual certificate holder to shoulder the complex administrative burden of joining and managing a TPA just to do a weekend job, how long can that be sustained before efficiency is critically impaired?
That's a great question.
Will the FAA, or perhaps international regulatory bodies, eventually see the value in streamlining compliance, perhaps creating a truly standardized, portable Part 120 status that's tied directly to the individual A&P certificate itself, making compliance as mobile as the technician rather than relying solely on the complexity of contractual tiers? That seems like a crucial conversation for how safety integrity can keep pace with the modern, high-demand aviation workforce.
A shift that would require a monumental legal and legislative effort, but one that would certainly reflect the reality of the mechanics who keep the world flying. Thank you for sharing your sources for this crucial deep dive. We hope this has given you the necessary insight to navigate the high-stakes, low-glory world of aviation maintenance compliance.